This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm Sharika Crawford, your host. Today, I'm with Dr. Kelly Baker-Josephs and Dr. Rupika Rizam. Dr. Josephs is a professor of English and Digital Humanities at the CUNY Graduate School and a professor of English at York College at CUNY. Dr. Rizam is an associate professor of English and secondary higher education at Salem State University. We're here to discuss their edited volume, The Digital Black Atlantic, published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2021. Welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you.
Thank you both for agreeing to do this interview, Kelly and Rupika. I usually like to start the interviews by asking the authors to discuss a little bit about their educational and intellectual background. And in particular, I'm really interested in hearing how both of you came to work in the digital humanities. Kelly, would you mind starting first?
I would not mind. And thank you again for having us, Sharika. Very few of us who are in digital humanities right now have some clear direct line that says this is where we were always heading. I was just working on something recently that had me go back to an early publication on Kamau Brathwaite and his usage of Sycorax's video style. And in doing that, that was my first scholarly publication. And I realized, oh, I've always been interested in digital stuff, though I didn't have the wordage for digital humanities then. But that was back in the early 2000s. And around 2009, 2010 is when I started working on Essex Salon, which would become a digital publication. It launched in 2010. And in doing that, in working on Essex Salon, which was part of the Small Acts project and was a digital platform for literary publications, I started thinking more about what the digital does. And I had to work with people who were trying to pull together digital poetry or trying to do more with the digital. And so from there, it just grew. And I started meeting people like Rupika, and Alex Hill. And he and I and Kayama Glover up at Barnard, we sort of grew into the Caribbean digital events. And it just, that was the kind of rolling movement that happened, which I think is common for many people in digital humanities. You don't go in saying, I'm going to do digital humanities. You start to look at the ways in which the digital and digital tools help you do something else that you were doing. And then it grows from there.
Hmm. And Rupika, how did you happen to get into digital humanities? And if you don't mind, perhaps talking a little bit about how we define, maybe in general terms, digital studies and/or digital humanities?
Absolutely. So, in a sense, my experiences were similar to Kelly's in that digital humanities solved a problem for me. When I was in graduate school at Emory, I was working on this intellectual cross currents between Black radicalism and colonized people who weren't African descended. And I was struggling with how to put into words some of these really rich intellectual cross currents. And when I was doing my dissertation research, I was at Stanford in the Huey Newton papers, and I came across the roles of subscribers for the Black Panther newspaper. And I thought, you know what, this would be really interesting to map. And I wonder what it would say, because there were places you'd expect someone to be subscribing to the Black Panther newspaper, like Cuba or Algeria. But then there are places like Sweden where I was quite surprised. And so then that really made me think about the ways that maps and other kinds of digital tools might be useful for addressing some of these situations where maybe trying to wrestle a complex idea onto a page is not actually the most effective way to do that. And so it turned out, this was, I believe, in the mid-2000s, it turned out that there was this whole emerging field of digital humanities that did just that. And so I learned more about that, and then really became interested in these questions of how the practices of digital humanities replicate colonialism, particularly colonialism and knowledge production. And that ended up becoming the subject of my first book, New Digital Worlds. And so in there, I really think about positioning digital humanities in two ways. The first is as using digital and computational tools to understand and interpret history, literature, culture. So it could be anything from using quantitative textual analysis to count words, see which words are more frequent in a corpus, see which words appear most frequently next to each other in a corpus, and therefore, you know, what could that mean for our interpretation of why words appear in proximity to each other? Or it could be something like the kinds of digital cultural mapping that I mentioned. And the second piece is using the lenses we have from the humanities for inquiry, like something like postcolonial theory, and applying them to our interpretation of digital objects and cultures to try and understand how the power dynamics of colonialism, of racism, shape people's experiences online.
So listening to both of you kind of discuss the way that you found yourself increasingly involved in this kind of emerging field of digital humanities really piqued my interest to how did you come to prepare this amazing volume? What was its origin? You know, how were you able to kind of draw in this eclectic, wonderful group of digital humanists? And then what scholarly contributions were you seeking to make, either to this kind of emerging digital humanities field or to a more established field like the Black Atlantic? And maybe, Rubika, maybe you could continue with that question.
Sure. So what actually happened was that independently of each other, Kelly and I were approached by a different publisher asking us about whether we had edited collections we would like to pursue. And I believe I was asked about postcolonial studies, and I believe Kelly might have been asked about Caribbean studies. And we both reached out to a mutual friend, Alex Heal, who Kelly works with on Digital Caribbean, Caribbean Digital, and various assorted initiatives. And we both said, we've been asked to do a volume. Would you like to do a volume with us? And Alex got the light bulb over his head and said, huh, you know what? I can just avoid having to do this and make them do a volume with each other. So that's primarily how we got connected. And when we talked about what we would do if we did a volume, with my background in post-colonial and African diaspora studies and Kelly's background in Caribbean studies, it seemed like an African diaspora approach would make the most sense. But we also were concerned about making sure that the volume was accessible to people and researchers and libraries in the African diaspora, wherever they were. And so we thought that publishing what would have been a very expensive volume with the original press that approached us wasn't the right approach. And instead, we decided to go to Debates in the Digital Humanities series, the University of Minnesota Press, where we knew they published open access volumes. So it was really crucial for us. It was really an ethical choice to think about doing a volume that would be available to researchers, regardless of whether they or their libraries could afford to buy the volume. And the contributions that we were really trying to make was to establish a body of work that could be cited. This is one of the challenges of doing our work, is that this is the first volume on African diaspora, really anything Black studies and digital humanities. And we wanted to try and not be prescriptive, not to be the last word, not to be definitive, but rather to open up the conversation by giving people a body of scholarship, a to cite, and a points of entry into talking about digital humanities in the context of the African diaspora, and with the hope that we would just be the first of many.
Like a foundational text that can generate, hopefully, a really robust kind of scholarly conversation. And I definitely feel that came across really well. I'm curious if we could focus just a moment on the framing, you know, the particular framing of the digital humanities volume that you and Kelly were working on. And your volume is great because, as you pointed out, there's just this array of contributions from scholars and library practitioners and even curators, and they're all working in this Black Atlantic digital humanities space. But I was also curious if you could kind of discuss a little bit about why was the Black Atlantic, you know, rather than the African diaspora, the kind of preferred intellectual framing to encompass this wide variety of digital humanities projects about Black people and their lived experiences worldwide. And maybe, Kelly, you might have something to say about that.
Yes, it's a great question. And I've been trying to think about that. We use the word African diaspora, or the terminology African diaspora, in our introduction. But we were really thinking, as we were working on the introduction, as we were thinking about the various thinkers that we wanted to engage in introducing this this range of digital practices and digital theoretical interventions, we started thinking about Gilroy's Black Atlantic. And we'd both been thinking through that. And we also wanted to think about, well, why digital Black Atlantic rather than Black Atlantic digital humanities? Or, there are so many different terminologies that we had both come through and to as we worked in, you know, there's post-colonial, there's Caribbean, there's just Black, there's Black code studies. There are so much terminology around trying to pull together this variety of all things Black in digital humanities. And we decided that the Gilroy move was our best move, or the one that made the most sense to us at the time. And so in the introduction, we go through some of that as well. Actually, we sort of list those terms that we've had, and we talk about the ways that the Black Atlantic allows us to think about the geographies more transparently to think about not just geography, but also temporal, the ways that Gilroy's theory is temporally set, and but also makes us think about geographies. What in that helps us frame the ways that scholars are using digital tools to think through spaces in the Black Atlantic? I don't know if that's quite answering the question, because we do use the word African diaspora, but we wanted to specifically set it within that theoretical time and frame. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. I think that it came across, particularly you're mentioning the geography, so that mobility question and Gilroy's work temporally and kind of spatially is set. It is in a frame, but at the same time, it was wonderful to see the variety of chapters, you know, in that volume that really did reflect of the kind of spatial and kind of temporal projects that can be pursued. I remember there was a chapter from an author talking about what was happening in Nigeria. You had, you know, one that was centered in the Midwest. I mean, so really, I thought that it worked really well. But I also, I had a kind of a sense that there was perhaps a conversation, or maybe you both are setting the tone for a kind of a thoughtful re-engagement with these kind of framings, you know, over time. There's been, you know, continual questions about, you know, what terminology, who's left out, what spatial frame gets, you know, excluded or included. And I thought that was a really novel way to kind of start thinking about this in a different light.
Yes. And Rubika can speak a little bit more towards this as well, because we in using those words, digital and Black and Atlantic, we were thinking about, as we said in the introduction, the juxtaposition of those words and what that means. And Rubika, you want to talk a little bit more? I'm putting you on the spot, but a little bit more about the juxtaposition of the words.
Absolutely. So, you know, we're not interested in thinking about ways that people are incidentally using technology in the African diaspora, and rather thinking about the ways that at those intersections of Blackness and technology are really productive conversations to be had about the ways that Black people have appropriated technologies to reframe a narrative. So it's not a story about how this typical story about how technologies have been used to disempower Black people, but rather how African diaspora communities are using technology to seize the means of the production of digital knowledge on their own terms and in their own words.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
And I feel like that actually speaks to something that I hope that we would have a chance to talk about. And Rubika, maybe you might want to continue with this. You both bring this out very well, what you pointed out now, this kind of refreshing approach of thinking about Black people and technology, and not just as a kind of a tool that kind of excludes or limits or oppresses, but the creative and innovative ways that they are constantly and have been using technology. But you also speak to And it was reinforced in several of the chapters by the various authors, the challenges though around the digital Black Atlantic. And I guess I mean both as kind of like a scholarly field, but also like the people who actually live in this space, even currently of a digital Black Atlantic. And so I was hoping that we might talk a little bit about what some of those challenges are. And, you know, how have you both or other scholars that you're or other people that you are you know, are, that you know, are confronting them? How are they responding to these challenges?
So I think this actually ties in well also to why we each selected Black Atlantic as a framing, which is that Gilroy's articulation is very much an interdisciplinary one. And in order to really fully engage with digital humanities in the context of the African diaspora, we really had to take an interdisciplinary approach. So what you'll find in the volume is scholarship on musicology and digital games and library and information studies and digital archives, all kinds of different approaches. And that's it's very challenging to deal with interdisciplinary scholarship. And so if you do this kind of work, what we're encountering are these multiple levels of complication from, first of all, working in a field that is already marginalized in the broader landscape of academic knowledge production, African diaspora studies, then doing so with so many different interdisciplinary approaches that kind of go beyond the kind of standard expectations of interdisciplinarity, which usually you'd say, okay, well, obviously you need history, economics, and so forth, but to be drawing from such diverse arrays of disciplines, it's very challenging to think through how do you bring these together. And yet it's fitting because Gilroy's formation is an interdisciplinary one. And so that was very helpful in negotiating that challenge. And I think the other challenge goes back to why we undertook the volume in the first place, which is how do you establish a politics of citation that is necessary to demonstrate that this work is legitimate when this is the first volume on it. And this is why we're doing the volume in the first place. And so we actually found that the interdisciplinary approach assisted with that because we were reaching into new media studies and e-Black studies and different areas of scholarship and sort of bringing them together to conceptualize a truly interdisciplinary approach.
And Kelly, I didn't know if you wanted to jump in here. One thing that I remember from your introduction and maybe one or both of you could speak to is something you brought up earlier, Rupika, when you were defining kind of digital studies and digital humanities. And this, it's a field in which to some degree computational approaches can be used. And yet at the same time, there is an unevenness or there can be a gap between, a scholar's or a practitioner's ability to fully utilize these new kind of computational approaches to do that project. So when you were talking about Stanford and looking at, the membership roles, right, and wanting to map that, I thought, wow, that's really great. But at the same time, I thought, wow, how, do I have the skills? Do I know how to do that? And so I wonder to what degree is that a conversation, even if it's not happening like formally in this digital humanities space. I mean, how much is the question about this preparation, the skills preparation to kind of carry out some of these digital projects is specific to the Black Atlantic or Black people in the digital in general?
Well, Rupika might be able to speak more to this, but I'm going to jump in and say that we've actually been talking about this in terms of the Caribbean specifically, thinking about not just access to digital tools though that is also a big challenge as well in some cases, especially in the region, right? But access to the skills and access to people who can teach the skills. So knowing the skill is not necessarily also being able to teach it. And we've been talking about, Shiler Spree, who's also who has a piece in the volume, an essay in the volume, runs Create Caribbean in the Caribbean, which is a digital center. But she's also now at University of West Indies, Mona. And we've been talking with her, some folks. Puerto Rico is where we were supposed to hold the last Caribbean Digital. And, you know, as with all conferences in 2020, that did not happen. We're still talking about it, though. So, you know, we've been thinking with some people in the region who are situated in the region, Puerto Rico, Jamaica, Dominica, Trinidad, about how to teach those skills, right? How to have the space, time, resources, read money here, because time is also a resource, but I mean money there, to teach those skills, how to use computational practices, et cetera, to do the kinds of things that especially people in the region are interested in. So people in the diaspora are not necessarily interested in the same things as people in the region. There are crossovers. I'm not saying we're interested in mutually exclusive things, but that is a conversation we're still working on that I think we don't have an answer yet. And it's not that you can just throw money at something, though, you know, please, anyone who has it, throw it at us. But thinking through who we have, who has time, and then how we can support that through grants, et cetera. It is a question we don't necessarily have an answer to yet.
Mm. No, I think you're actually kind of picking back up to, you know, Rubika's your point at the very beginning with the politics of citation. I mean, just for, you know, us who happen to be in this sphere of academia, you know, there is, you know, a kind of process by which we are recognized and get promoted and receive tenure. There's, you know, a whole kind of established process that, to your point, Rubika, you know, this is kind of, it's emerging, but it's also kind of a marginalized space and the rules have not been set. It hasn't been integrated fully, or even maybe you might argue at all yet into these processes. And at the same time, you know, Kelly, you're bringing to bear that the people whom would be very interested in, you know, extending into the Caribbean and working with people based and living in the Caribbean to teach these kinds of skills perhaps are at institutions where, you know, they have to think about promotion and tenure and following into these, you know, kind of established norms and processes that have not fully, you know, kind of integrated or incorporated kind of the digital humanities into their understanding of the production of knowledge. And so I think these are the volume and the different projects and the ways in which these authors are kind of wrestling with that at different levels, you know, as a librarian, as, you know, as a professor of English, you know, as someone who heads up, I believe you had one for someone from the Midwest who heads up, you know, a Black Studies Institute. You're seeing people trying to kind of grapple with, you know, at multiple levels, not just the content, but also kind of community to, you know, institutional kind of interactions, but also these larger questions and challenges. It was really thought provoking, and I found it immeasurably very, very useful.
Can I jump in and add one thing?
Yeah, please.
I want our readers not to assume that we're in a people in the global north have, people in the global south have not kind of situation, because, for example, there's thriving and relatively decently funded digital humanities community in Nigeria, for example, and they've been doing a lot of work with other scholars in West Africa and kind of bringing them in for workshops and things like that. Southern Africa has a very, so South Africa and surrounding countries have a very relatively well-developed digital humanities community as well. And so I think it's sometimes people assume that, you know, maybe, you know, countries in Africa, the scholars there like just don't have that. But I mean, there are scholars doing this work, making really crucial contributions to scholarship. And also they're redistributing the resources they have to build up their regional communities.
Absolutely. That was a wonderful chapter from the author and the scholar working in Nigeria for that very purpose. It's, you know, basically, listeners, you can see I'm really enthusiastic about the volume, because there's really kind of a wealth of, at least for me, relatively new information about kind of thinking along these ways, and also trying to see how people are working through building these kind of borderless kind of communities in really interesting and innovative ways. Which brings me to something that I'm really interested in hearing you both talk about, which is both of you perhaps discussing, identifying maybe a Digital Black Atlantic project that you're familiar with or are working on yourselves, and perhaps discussing how it gets to some of these central like ideas in the volume. And maybe Kelly, you might want to begin there, and then Rupika jumps in.
Yes. So now I had thought of something else before to answer this question, but I want to start by, as I mentioned earlier, I mentioned Shyler Esprit, who's in Dominica. Well, she's not, as I said, in Dominica at the moment, but her program Create Caribbean is there. It's just fascinating what she has done, right? With students and with so she has various levels. So it was something that grew. It didn't start off where it is. But please do read that chapter and visit Create Caribbean to see it's there's not just one project, right? So I can't really answer the question with this specific example, but I want to think about there are centers where that do different projects, right? So there's that I find really exciting, that it's not just one project tied to one person, that if that person decides I'm not doing this anymore, or something happens to that person and they can't do it anymore, that the project goes down. It's a collaboration is at the heart of much of DH, and to have centers that will carry on work that's not personality centered, maybe is a good way of saying it, or person individual centered. I think this is not exactly a project in the way that you're asking, but I want to draw attention to, as Rubika did as well, to places that are hives of activity, right? And then a particular project that I've just recently been writing about and thinking about, so it's at the top of my mind, is the one we closed the volume with, which is in the same boats. And that's also a collaborative project in many ways. So Rubika did part of it. I did part of it. And when I say part, we contributed data sets to it. But it's headed by Alex Hill and Kayama Glover. And so the title is In the Same Boats, as I said, and it is thinking about Black intellectuals who were traveling, whose travels maybe intersected, and maybe at some moments they were literally, you know, in the same boat. So we're mapping, right now it's at 12, and it's built to grow. And it has grown over the past couple of years. So we're at 12 Black intellectuals who are their movements from 1890 to 2010. Well, not all of them lived that long, but that's the range of the project. So mostly 20th century Black intellectuals, how they moved through the world, where they stopped, where they went to conferences, where they gave talks, where centers brought them in to do workshops, etc. And looking at places that ended up being where a lot of Black intellectuals ended up in particular times. So it's temporal and spatial, as we were saying earlier. So I think that's a fantastic project to think about the ways that digital tools allow us to know things that or guess at sometimes, because we don't know specifics. We don't know if people met, etc. But to guess, speculate at things, and also know things, to see things that we couldn't see with just the archive, the individual archives that Rupika might be looking at, the Du Bois archive, and I might be looking at the Brathwaite archive, and we are not talking to each other. So there's a way that the digital tools and the way that they're using them here allow us to do a certain type of inquiry in African diasporic studies, Black Atlantic studies, that make that project an interesting one to close out the volume. Rupika?
I would actually go back to one of the earliest projects that's discussed in the volume, which is Sonia Donaldson's project, Lift Every Voice and Sing, or Singing the Nation into Being, which is a project that is trying to promote a conversation around the meaning of James Weldon Johnson and J. Rosamond Johnson's Lift Every Voice and Sing. And so what the project does is create a collection of performances scraped from YouTube, performances of Lift Every Voice and Sing, which Donaldson uses to talk about sort of the ephemerality of archives, to think about, you know, what it means that sort of these are reliant on a commercial platform, that they're there 1 minute, they're not there the next minute. And to think about what this means in terms of the broader implications for the democratization of culture and what it means to use commercialized platforms as sites of memory. And it's a really wonderful essay. It's a really wonderful project. And also in many ways, you know, even though it is in a sense, a single authored project, even just on the project site itself, you see Sonia, Dr. Donaldson, situating her work in a constellation, in a community of scholars, including Kelly and I, as people who are all thinking around these issues. And even though we may be doing our individual projects, that we're also all kind of thinking with each other as well.
Well, it would appear to me that you've both successfully launched this edited volume, and I am eager to hear whether you're currently or you're kind of thinking about future projects. And Rupika, maybe you could start first.
Yes. Yeah, so using the when I collected the data for the Du Bois project, it was while I was also working on a data project on W.B. Du Bois. So that's something I'm working on. It's called the Global Du Bois. It's a series of data visualizations that's trying to challenge the idea that Du Bois turned to anti-colonialism later in his life, and to suggest and argue through data visualizations that, in fact, that was something that was part of his career from the very beginning. So I'm working on that. And I'm also working on a book called Insurgent Academics, which is under contract with Johns Hopkins University Press. And it's looking at the ways that scholarly moves that are being advocated for in critical university studies by white scholars, moves like, you know, open access to knowledge and collaborating with communities, are actually the very tactics that scholars like Du Bois and other scholars of color have used in the academy to survive. And so it's looking at this in creating this intellectual history of scholars in Native and Indigenous studies, African-American studies, Asian studies, who are Latinx studies, who are the progenitors of the work that we do today in digital humanities, even if, you know, their technological ecosystems are completely different than ours.
Hmm. And Kelly?
Yes. I've been sitting here thinking I wanted to circle back just for a moment when Rupika was speaking about Sonia's essay, which is in the first section of the volume, I wanted to say, so several of these essays are, many of them, are reflective on the process of the project. And so you asked earlier about the computational skills, et cetera. And some of our essays do have that, right? We have graphs, we have charts, we have tables. But Sonia's essay for me was really theorizing ephemerality, right? And so her project is awesome, but she's thinking here also about the theory of what it means to have loss in the digital space, right? And it's something I've been thinking about, and that's something I'm turning to in my current work. So I'm also doing some Brathwaite stuff that is taking up my time right now, which I'm happy for it to take up my time. I love all things Brathwaite, and he's at the heart of my digital praxis and theorizing in many cases, but I'm, you know, doing some special issues on one of his essays specifically, and one on just his work in general for the Journal of West Indian Literatures. So that's taking up some of my time right now, but I'm also thinking about death, and that sounds terrible. I'm thinking about death in the digital space. I'm thinking about both in terms of human death and how that is treated in digital spaces and not treated in digital spaces, but also deaths of projects, which may be related to human death in some cases. So I've been thinking through. So that's why Sonia's essay leads me into talking about this in some ways. How we mark death and how the digital space doesn't allow us to die, and how some things die before they are sunsetted is a word that we use in digital humanities for closing out a project. So that's what I've been looking at just now, and it's the last part of a larger project on that's called Caribbean Articulations, that thinks about storytelling in Caribbean spaces. And so this is the closing out, is to think about death of people and death of projects in digital spaces.
I'm looking forward to following you both on both of these projects, or multiple, actually, this Caribbean Articulations, and I have been following Rupika's Global Dubois project for some time, and this has been a really fascinating conversation. Thank you both for agreeing to do the interview with me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find the Digital Black Atlantic on the New Books Network webpage. I also will have linked several of the projects that were referenced in our interview, and I look forward to sharing with you again some great works. Until next time.